The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support comes from Grady Health Foundation, presenting Move for Grady Saturday, April 27th, featuring a family-friendly bike ride through Atlanta's in-town neighborhoods. There's a ride, run, or walk distance for everyone, benefiting Grady Health System. More at moveforgrady.com.
WABE in Atlanta, this is City Lights. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thank you for listening. Atlanta artist Peter Ferrari is the founder of the annual Forward Warrior mural painting event in Cabbage Town. And his work has achieved iconic status in our city and beyond. Later this hour, City Lights senior producer Kim Drobe speaks with Ferrari about his new solo exhibition, Covalent, on view at ABV Gallery. Plus, our series Speaking of Poetry shines a light on Atlanta poet Carlos Barboza. First, the protagonist of Stacey Abrams' new novel, Avery Keane, is extraordinary in many ways, much like her creator. The voting rights activist, lawyer, and politician is a prolific author, having written more than a dozen books. Her latest is a political thriller titled Rogue Justice. And she joins us now via Zoom to talk about the book. Stacey Abrams, welcome back to City Lights.
Thank you for having me.
Since we last spoke, you earned yet another distinction, having been named the inaugural Ronald W. Walters Endowed Chair for Race and Black Politics at Howard University. Congratulations.
Thank you. I am very excited about the opportunity and what it means, not just for Howard, but what it means for Georgia and for our nation.
Very exciting. Now, on to Rogue Justice. Early in the book, we learned that the United States President Brandon Stokes was brought down by an explosive investigation. What the young Supreme Court clerk Avery Keane knew and how she knew it had roiled Capitol Hill for many months. For those who have not read your previous novel, While Justice Sleeps, what can you tell us about Avery Keane?
Avery is a smart, both intellectually savvy and street smart young clerk who is figuring out who and what she's going to be. She stumbled into her earlier responsibility because of her mentor, Justice Wynn, but she is now figuring out what do you do when you have a skill set and have an obligation. She has to really grapple with the conversation of choosing to take action instead of having action foisted upon her.
Avery has an uncanny ability to recall what she has read or seen, and that is not a parlor trick. Tell us about an eidetic memory.
So eidetic memory describes a range of capacities, but largely it applies to the ability to recall copious amounts of information. There's some who call it a photographic memory. There are people who can remember every biographical detail in their lives. There are those who can remember the weather on every single day. There are others who, like Avery, can just consume vast amounts of information and recall it at will. Now, that is not to say she remembers every single thing every single day, but it's pretty close.
This quality is both strength and torment to Avery, as she remembers the bad experiences as vividly as the good ones. She's facing a crisis as her boss is in a coma. What had he done before he became ill?
So without giving away While Justice Sleeps, and for anyone who hasn't read it, you don't have to read While Justice Sleeps to enjoy Rogue Justice. I'm very careful about that, but they are connected stories. And in While Justice Sleeps, Justice Nguyen uncovers a fairly labyrinthine conspiracy that he uses her skills and her wit to reveal and to uncover. And so as we head into Rogue Justice, he's in a coma, which he was in for most of the first book, but his tutelage and his meddling continue to linger over her life.
And now what draws Avery into another crisis on a global scale, we should add.
Yes. So Avery is, you know, trying to grapple with the aftermath. The Rogue Justice picks up 4 months after the end of While Justice Sleeps. So While Justice Sleeps really focused on the last days of the Supreme Court term, and Rogue Justice begins at the opening of the next term. But it's also an election year, and she has been held both responsible for and is reviled for by some her role in bringing down a president. But the president isn't willing to stay down. And so she is in the midst of a bit of a political maelstrom when she is tipped off by a fellow clerk to what could be a vast challenge with our FISA court, which is the secret court that can wiretap Americans and international corporations suspected of terrorism or other national security threats.
Yeah, that was a scary thing to learn about, at least for me. More on that later. It would be easy for readers at first to presume Brandon Stokes is Donald Trump, but he is not. Stokes is an amalgam, although I did think of his last name as a verb, as in he stokes fear and hatred. Am I onto something there?
If so, it was unconscious, oh. But I will remind readers that I crafted Brandon Stokes in 2010.
Ah!
So long before there was any conversation of a later, again, to use the resonance of last names, before Trump became a thing, Brandon Stokes was an amalgam of presidents, but also of profiles of leaders that I'd studied over the last 20 so years. I read political biographies very aggressively. And for me, he pulled on all of these threads. He's a smart guy. He's very smart. He's very savvy, but he suffers from some of the challenges that often assail those who have extraordinary access to leadership and to power. And that is, how do you measure your sense of right and wrong against the job you were actually asked to do? And Brandon stumbles, the president stumbles, and Avery is the one who realizes it and helps try to bring him to justice. But what we also know is justice doesn't work out. It's not linear and it's not absolute. And in this case, justice has gone rogue on a number of levels.
I should point out too that you do not take sides. There are no good guys, bad guys, Democrats versus Republicans. So that was all on me, thinking about Stokes as a verb. Although I did find it amusing that while in his library, Avery asks him, "Do you read, Mr. President?" I had fun with that.
Indeed. No, and in your defense, she is a clerk, but he is a Republican, and the Congress is led by Democrats. So there is partisanship. But part of what I try to do with all of my writing, especially with these novels, is to illuminate that there's a complexity to who we are, what we believe, and neither party gets it all right or all wrong. And it's about the quality of leadership as much as it is the ideology that drives that leadership.
You do that in your public service too.
I try.
You succeed. You do give Stokes some funny lines. I like when he says, quote, "On the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November, I'm going to crush them at the polls on Election Day like Ronald Reagan and Barack Obama's love child." See, you were even bipartisan with that.
I think it gets lost during election time, but during my tenure in the legislature, I was intentional about being able to work with both sides. I've become more polarizing, I think, in part because I'm more public, but our nation doesn't allow for unilateral decision-making and you cannot be so hyper-partisan and try to be successful. We've seen people try it, but we also watch them almost without question, they will stumble and fail. And so in my politics, in my writing, in my thinking, I have a very clear point of view, but my responsibility is to allow others to invite them in with their points of view, to show them what I think and what I see, but to create space so that they can see the story themselves. Hmm.
This story unfolds over 24 days. There are a couple of murders, and the suspense increases rapidly. As the plot develops, we're introduced to various government agencies and learned several acronyms. You mentioned one earlier that I find especially scary. Take us back to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. Is this okay?
It is. I mean, we spent more time talking about and thinking about FISA during the last administration than I think most Americans had ever been aware of. Although it came up the first time post 9/11. But the FISA court has existed for a long time. And FISC, which is the proper acronym is FISC, but the act that created it is FISA. But it's embedded in the title. It's Foreign Intelligence Surveillance. And so in order to spy on those who would harm us, we have an entire court system. And that court gets appointed. Those names are public, but their decisions are not. And so unlike every other court of law, this is a court that operates in secret. There are moments where they can opt to reveal or Congress can compel revelation, but it is a very high bar. And it is there's a very low number of decisions that have ever been made public. And so we have, in order to protect our nation, we have empowered this panel of judges to make these decisions. And so for me, it was knowing that the court exists, what happens if that court becomes subject to attack and the vulnerability of absolute secrecy becomes a weapon that gets wielded by those who do not want it to succeed?
If you are just joining us, this is City Lights on WABE. I'm Lois Reitzes, and my guest is Stacey Abrams. We're discussing her new political thriller, Rogue Justice. A very significant author is Jared Wynn, a retired Navy analyst and military-trained cybersecurity expert. His skills, as well as his devotion, come in handy in this story. What does Jared contribute to helping Avery solve the crime?
So we meet Jared in While Justice Sleeps. He is the son of Howard Wynn, our comatose Supreme Court justice. But Jared has his own skill set. He has his own mindset. And where he is so important in this story is, one, that he provides the Google esque research. He's her version of ChatGPT. So she can ask him questions, get information almost immediately. He can find things out, but he also can see things that she can't because this is his bailiwick. But I also love Jared's character because he sees her. He understands who she is. And even though they're in the beginning of their relationship, he understands how to help her navigate these roles that she's taken on, these challenges that she has absorbed, but also how to mitigate the crises that not only prevail in the world she's entering to sort of help save America, but what's also happening in her personal life as she's trying to balance all of these parts of herself. And so he is the ChatGPT for her brain, but also he is there for her heart.
And he has dinner on the table when she comes
home.
He does. Does it get any better?
Look, a guy who can get you dinner and build you a Faraday cage to keep you protected, that's a handy kind of guy.
I should say. Okay. This is where, that is to say, Jared's expertise and where that leads. This is where the author, you, had me wondering about how you know all of this tech information. Please tell us about your research into cybersecurity and power grids.
So I have a very dear friend, Phyllis Newhouse, who runs one of the nation's top cybersecurity firms. And she and I had a conversation before I started writing Rogue Justice that sort of sparked for me the conceit. But once she started me on it, I actually spent months listening to podcasts about the dark web, doing a lot of research, making sure I could understand enough that I'm not a cyber expert. I do not claim that. I'm not pretending that. But for me, when I write about complicated topics, I want to make certain I understand enough that an expert doesn't scoff. they may look askance, but they don't scoff at it. And so I give credit to Phyllis for helping me get started, but I do a lot of deep research. I did the same on the power grid. So I know much too much now about how our power is gathered and deployed. I know the politics behind it. As you saw with all the acronyms, basically our power is delivered by acronym. So, but I believe in doing very deep research. For every book I've written, whether it was understanding ethnobotany or doing research on forensic anthropology, when I write, I want to be so conversant that when I'm telling the story, someone who knows about the topic doesn't get pushed out of the story. The worst thing is that you're immersed in a narrative and then there's something discordant that just throws you out of the story. And so I try to make certain I know enough personally that when you're in the story with me, even if it's a little bumpy, it's not jarring.
That's impressive enough. You're also introducing others among us to new terms. Hacktivists, exfiltration. These are all new to me.
Yep.
And I know this novel is a thriller that's ultimately meant to entertain readers. But with the power grid, should we be up all night worrying about these things? I had trouble going to sleep after the part in the book about the danger with the power grid.
I mean, everything I write is possible. I'm not saying it's probable, but it's entirely possible. And that, I think, is part of the reason I spend so much time in the research. I love science fiction. Science fiction is clearly something I adore, but it's often so far in the future that it seems both possible and impossible at the same time. But when I'm writing fiction in the current day, I want us to be not, I don't want you to be anxious, but I do want you to be aware. And we have a vulnerable power grid. Much of the research I did was based on articles that I've read, but also journal articles. And I spent a lot of time reading past reports that Congress has commissioned, that FERC has issued. And so all of the things I lay out could entirely come to fruition. That said, now that we know, we should ask better questions. We should ask questions about who's running our power grid. We have a public service commission in Georgia. We should know what the PSC does. We have these commissions all across the country. We have different entities that are producing our power. And as someone who's very involved through Rewiring America in the conversation of electrifying our nation as we move towards better climate action, we have to be sensitive to what that means and what does that look like. So I don't want anyone staying awake at night worrying, but you should be paying more attention because these things are absolutely possible.
And acting. Another important character in this story is FBI Agent Lee. He's a friend to Avery, almost like an uncle figure. What is his role in the story?
So we meet him also in While Justice Sleeps. And one of my challenges as a writer is once I create a character I really like, I don't like letting them go. So I try to bring as many of them with me wherever I am. And what I admire about him is that he's very much in the sort of stereotypical mold of an FBI agent. He's no nonsense, but he is absolutely devoted to this young woman that he has watched take on responsibilities well beyond her age and her posture. And so his protectiveness often lends itself to allowing her more access than she might possibly get. Although I did check with some friends to make sure who are in positions of power. Everything I let her do, there are ways to make it happen. So it's not far-fetched that she could be a part of some of these things, given her expertise. But what I love about him is that he has a very clear moral compass. He has a very clear set of rules that he operates by. He doesn't break them, but he understands that they have to bend to get things right.
He's a good politician.
He's not. He's actually not a politician. He has a counterweight or counterpart in Sarah Beth Gale in the story. And part of it is that for him, it's not politics. His job is to protect people. And he takes that so seriously that he will do what is necessary. He will never break the law. He will never bend his moral fiber, bend his moral compass, I'm mixing my metaphors, but he won't do something wrong. And indeed, there's a moment where that becomes very clear, but he also recognizes that rigidity can be just as dangerous as fluidity. And so he tries to operate in that space in between, which is where most decisions have to be made.
I think you just expressed much more eloquently what I was trying to say about his being a good politician. I know the FBI is not a political group. I found it remarkable and felt a bit wistful that in this book, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, the FBI Special Director of the Cyber Investigative Joint Task Force, and the Vice President all are women. Is it especially rewarding for you to write fiction that could reflect better representation in many aspects of professional life and public service?
Absolutely. I try to do that with race, with gender. And for me, it's about what's possible and what should be comfortable. And while these things are true, I don't spend a lot of time, pontificating about what it means, because we know what it means. You saw what it means. When you see the names of the characters, there should be nothing that distracts you from the story because these are women, because some of them are women of color, because they're men of color. The story stands alone, but it is enhanced by and informed by their experiences. We often take race and gender and diversity writ large as a threat to a normative state. And what I want us to understand is that these things can mutually coexist. In fact, that our best days are when it absolutely naturally becomes true that diversity is reflected in how we do and who we are and what we deliver.
It's important to note that you do not engage in gender discrimination among admirable characters and villains. In fact, two of the most ruthless characters in this story are women, though one has a tragic backstory that reveals a systematic flaw in how some women are treated in the U.S. military. How does your fiction make us think more about issues in our society that need to be fixed and will motivate us to take action?
So, as you point out, the story revolves around issues of the energy grid and the vulnerability of our society to cyber attack, but we also have a very challenging approach to justice for our military. There is a doctrine known as the Ferris Doctrine that essentially denies access to the civilian courts to military members who experience harm during their service. And I talk about it a little bit in the book. The origin of the Ferris Doctrine had nothing to do with some of the challenges we are thinking about today, but we have an entire segment of our society that cannot get justice when they need it. And what I want to explore in the story also is, what are the consequences of denying justice to those we ask to protect our lives and protect our nation and protect our ideals? And often in my stories, I try to pick one or two things. This is a longer book, so I want it to weave together multiple stories. But to the very beginning of our conversation, my goal is to illuminate, to alert, and to educate. What we do with knowledge when we have it is up to us, but I want to find an entertaining way for us to have access that isn't overwhelming, that isn't dogmatic, that isn't didactic, but that is intriguing, engaging, and for some, a catalyst to do something about it.
Author and so much more, Stacey Abrams. She'll discuss her new thriller, Rogue Justice, at the Carter Center on Tuesday, May 30th at 7 p.m. More information is on our website, wabe.org/citylights. In a moment, the prolific Atlanta artist Peter Ferrari discusses Covalent, his new exhibition at ABV Gallery. Amplifying Atlanta, this is WABE.
Now on view at Skadfash, Manish Arora's Life is Beautiful. Renowned for dazzling designs in a rainbow of colors, Manish Arora has brought the talent and craftsmanship of India's rich sartorial history to the global forefront, earning international acclaim on runways across three continents. Designing in India since the 1990s, Arora's glittering garments celebrate extravagant expressions of self through varied materials, techniques, and silhouettes in a triumphant union of Western and Eastern aesthetics adapted to today's multicultural society with a touch of humor. Find out more at scadfash.org.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/freechecking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
This is City Lights on WABE. I'm Lois Wrights. It's great to have you along. Atlanta artist Peter Ferrari is known for his use of vivid colors, dynamic compositions, and his abstract expressionist style. He's the founder of the annual Forward Warrior mural painting event in Cabbage Town, and his work has achieved iconic status in our city and beyond. His new solo exhibition, Covalent, is on view at ABV Gallery through June 3rd. And when Ferrari recently spoke with City Light senior producer Kim Drobes, he explained how his artistic journey began.
I grew up in the city. We moved here in 1991, and I lived in Midtown. And so a lot of times we would go ride our bikes around the city and go through parking garages and old, you know, abandoned warehouses and things like that. And I saw a lot of graffiti and different street art on those walls, and eventually started doing some of it myself. And as I got older, my mom, sort of in an effort to dissuade me from doing things like that, which were a little dangerous and illegal, she bought me a bunch of acrylic paints and some canvas and things like that. And I started painting, you know, more deliberately and with more of a fine art angle. And so over time, I kind of combined those two things, working on my fine art, my studio art, and then also doing exterior murals in a similar style. So they both kind of happened at the same time. And I was lucky enough to be noticed by some different folks around town. And yeah, that's been my career now for, looks like about 13 years now.
Wow, that's fantastic. Well, in Covalent, it's clear that you are adding even more to your visual vocabulary, as it were. How has your work evolved over the years, and what's guided your shifting interests?
Yeah, I started out making very different work. I was kind of known for these, what I would call pipe murals. And they're sort of a collection of twisting lines and sort of abstract shapes. And that was something I did early on quite a bit. And, you know, I think I just got bored with that. And I wanted to try to expand, you know, my creative reach and really try to push myself. I think it's very easy as an artist to do what sells, you know, to do what you're getting the best response out of. And that makes sense from some angles. And then I think as artists, we're also obligated to push ourselves and to change what we're doing. So over time, yeah, my work has seen a lot of different aesthetics. I've gone through a few different styles, and recently I really fell in love with woodworking. So using painted pieces of wood to sort of create images and abstract paintings that way. It's a much more tactile material. You can sand it, you paint it, you know, gloss it, make it matte. There's just a lot you can do with it. And so I love the weathered look of wood. I love that you can stain it. You know, there's just a lot you can do with the material, and it's much, much more durable. And then you get to use a lot of fun power tools also, which are a lot of fun to use as long as you're safe. So yeah, it's always an evolution, I think. I don't ever want to stop evolving. And hopefully I'll hang in there with this style for a while, because I think people seem to enjoy it, and I really enjoy making it.
Are there any particular challenges that come along with the woodworking?
Yeah, well, currently it's physical space. My studio is in South Atlanta, and I'm working out of a 700 square foot sort of space, and that's divided into a few other studios. And so there's sort of a painting room, and then there's a dust room, I call it, which is where all the wood cutting happens. And we try and keep the dust down as much as possible, but it's tricky. So I try and keep it clean, and, you know, make sure I'm always wearing respirators and things like that. And hopefully in the next few years, I'll be expanding to a bigger studio, and I can have all the space that I need. But either way, it's a lot of fun. I don't mind getting messy and dusty in the studio.
Well, covalent is a particle physics term. It's not everybody's strongest subject in school. Would you explain the term and why the show's pieces fit in with it?
Sure. I'm sure there'll be a scientist who hears this who is going to correct me, and you'll probably get emails about it. But from my point of view and what I've learned, covalent is kind of the bond that exists between a lot of organic and biological molecules. So things like water and methane and the amino acids that make up you know, proteins and our own bodies are held together by covalent bonds. And so I wanted to tie into something that was sort of at the root of life. You know, we think about life as being separate things, you know, plants and animals and humans and et cetera. But in truth, you know, we're all made of the same stuff. They may be organized differently. You know, the elements may come in so many different varieties, but in the end, we're all sort of made of these basic organic compounds. And that just really inspires me. To this day, I just find it fascinating, just the amount of variety and things like that that we have on this planet. So I wanted to tap into that very basic understanding that hopefully some of us remember the bonds from high school chemistry, you know, covalent, ionic, and that sort of stuff. So yeah, hopefully I tapped into those very basic understandings that we all share and that we all share with all living things.
Oh, I love that. So yeah, the pieces definitely seem to play with the possibilities between like chaos and order, and you've got shapes and compositions that seem spontaneous in design, but meticulous in execution. Will you talk about how you achieve that balance?
I love that description. Thank you. Yeah, I think, you know, I've sort of evolved the techniques as the production was going on. So earlier on, there was a lot of layering different strips of wood and then sort of redividing them and then assembling them. So, you know, once again, tapping into sort of how nature works as entropy, you know, disintegrates one form, then that energy is used to create a new form and sort of all these different cycles take place. So sometimes I would make a piece and think I was done. And then 2 weeks later, I would decide, no, I'm going to completely cut it up and rearrange it. And so every time you do that, you sort of get this continual division and continual complexity that comes with each level of division. So I definitely appreciate that you notice that sort of ordered chaos and the way things sort of fall into place at the end. Hopefully the viewer gets that.
Absolutely. Well, one piece in the show I saw on your Instagram through a reveal video where you pull up the tape and then all of a sudden there's this prismatic dance of color filling a circle almost as tall as you. It reminds me of a kaleidoscope. How do you think about light and color and pattern in nature and translate it into your own visual language?
Yeah. Well, the title of that piece is Total Internal Reflection, which is, I believe, a gemological term describing sort of why are diamonds sparkly? You know, what is it about what a diamond does to light that creates that sparkle and that allure? And I didn't actually know the term when I was doing that piece. And there was sort of a post hoc, you know, rationalization of, oh, well, this describes this really well. And just the notion of light and the refraction of light and how necessary it is for us as a species, you know, to see light, to see color, and how those variations really tell us about the world that we're in. And I think, you know, I'm always balancing, with this show at least, I'm always balancing aesthetics with concept. And this one, I just kind of went all for aesthetics. I was like, I want lots of color. I want lots of pattern. I want something that someone is just going to be transfixed by and really take time and enjoy staring at. So hopefully it sort of cuts across both of those aspects. And hopefully the title of the piece ties back into the science and the nature that I'm going for in the show.
Well, that one had really sparked my interest. Is there another piece that's in the show that you would like to describe for us?
Sure. There are a few what I would say are representational pieces. So I have kind of one side of the gallery is mostly abstract, and they're based around geological concepts and some biological concepts as well. But then there's a small group of paintings. I did some birds and a few flowers and actually a couple of human skulls in this style. And it's a different technique than I've used before. So rather than putting everything into a square or a circle, the pieces are actually cut out in the forms of the things themselves. So it looks like a bird. It looks like a flower. And it was just a very different technique that I had used. I'm using a router to sort of clean up the edges, which I don't normally do. And I just started that towards the end of my work process. And it's one of those things that you kind of have to see to get what I'm talking about, but it's like painting with wood. So using the colored painted wood, rearranging the pieces on a representational form, and then routing all the edges so it looks very, very intentional and like every individual piece was hand cut to fit. And it really just is going to open a lot of doors for me in terms of my work moving forward. I feel like I can paint with wood right now, which is something I've been going for a while. Definitely recommend going to the gallery and seeing it in person so you get a better idea of what I'm talking about. But it's certainly a breakthrough and something I'm really excited about pursuing in the future more.
Oh, that's very cool. Well, let's talk about the gallery for a minute. ABV is definitely a community pillar. And the owner, Greg Mike, I see a kinship between your work and design sensibilities and his. And I know you guys go way back. Can you talk about how you and Greg Mike and ABV all kind of blossomed in the Atlanta art scene together?
Yeah. The early 2010s was a big time for public art and street art in Atlanta. You had folks like me and Greg, you had Living Walls. There was just kind of this feeling in the air back then. And it was a really great time, sort of a rising tide raises all boats situation. And Greg and I think I showed with him at a show called Supernatural Circus back in 2010. And they were a pretty new gallery at that point, maybe 2 years old, 1 or 2 years old. We both come from a street art graffiti background. We both, I think, really appreciate contemporary art and design. And I think we're both hard workers. You know, we both have our events that we put on, and we're both passionate about the community that we're in. So it's worked out really well. And yeah, I've known Greg for 13, 14 years now. And Nate as well over at ABV does a lot of work. And there's a lot of good folks over there who really work hard to bring some great stuff to the folks of Atlanta. So very appreciative of them and all the help that they've provided to me over the years.
Well, speaking of hard work and community, you founded the annual mural event Forward Warrior in 2012, I believe?
Yes.
Would you share what your inspiration for the event name came from and how the event has evolved over the years?
Sure. Yeah, the event name is a bit of a tongue twister, I know, but you did great. Yeah, a lot of W's and R's. Initially it was just something that an old roommate and I used to say to one another when we were feeling kind of down. You know, it's sort of this, you know, stoic idea of you just keep going. You know, you don't focus on the past. You don't focus on the hardships in front of you. You just sort of move forward, warrior. And it just became, you know, a refrain around our house. You know, moving forward, I wanted to be doing more murals. I wanted to get more involved in the scene of Atlanta. So I said, let's do a live painting event. I had different friends who were musicians, you know, and we'd go see their shows and their gigs. And I said, you know, this could be something that artists could do as well. We could have public painting shows. And, you know, different people have done this sort of thing over the years, for sure. But this was very intentional. I invited specific artists. And the first one was actually right on the Beltline, or what is now the Beltline, back in 2012. And we had 12 artists, and we just painted on panels in the back of this art gallery called Melvin Gallery. And it was very small, but it was really well received. And in 2013, I was invited to bring the event to Public Walls in Castleberry Hill. And I worked with, I think, probably about 15 artists that year. And we actually painted physical public walls. The year after that, we were invited to go to Cabbage Town and paint along the Wiley Street wall, which is about a half mile wall that is the side of a CSX train yard. So lots and lots of space. It's about 30 feet high in some spots. It had been kind of an eyesore for a while. They were going back and forth with having it tagged with graffiti and painting it over. And so eventually they just said, let's do a mural event here. And that was 8-9 years ago now in Cabbage Town. And every year we bring 40 to 50 artists out. We have scaffolding, we have paint for them, and they paint murals over over some of the old murals, actually. There's so much art there that we're having to paint over it at this point. So yeah, it's an amazing event. This year will be September 16th in Cabbage Town. So if you're around, I'd love to have you come out and see. It's a really, really well-oiled machine at this point, and everyone kind of knows what they're doing. I just need to get the equipment there and make sure everyone's happy, and then we get beautiful art for the rest of the year. So if you haven't been, I highly recommend coming out this fall.
Atlanta artist Peter Ferrari speaking with City Lights senior producer Kim Drobes. Covalent is on view at ABV Gallery through June 3rd. You can join Ferrari for an artist talk at ABV this Saturday, May 27th at 6:30 p.m. More information is on our website, wabe.org/citylights. Coming up, our series Speaking of Poetry shines a light on Atlanta poet Carlos Barboza. Amplifying Atlanta, this is 90.1 WABE. This is City Lights on WABE. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thank you for being here. It's time now for our series Speaking of Poetry, where Atlanta's creative lyricists share the rhyme and reason behind the art of language.
Hi, I'm Carlos Barboza. I like to think of my poetry as a conversation, sometimes more of a pep talk, but almost always as communion. My poems are flowers, and I am just as proud of their roots and thorns as I am their petals. I like to think of my work as part of the grand ecosystem and garden that is the Atlanta poetry scene. I started writing poetry in high school, at first as a hobby and later as a necessity. I've grown and matured alongside with my poetry, and I really can't imagine what my life would be like without it. I'm inspired by just about anything and everything. By the people in my life, my family and friends, by current events, and honestly, anything that makes me stop and think, be it politics or insects or anything in between. I would say my process is almost the absence of a process. I've often been told I don't know how to shut up, and that seems to be the process in and of itself. I've practiced my craft to the point where I am just waiting for the next bit of inspiration to strike. Performances have always made me nervous. But a mentor of mine used to always say that you're only nervous because you care, and quite honestly, I care a lot. Through my experiences, I've learned that oftentimes, as much as I need to express myself, someone else needs to hear it, and that's usually what helps me get over the nerves and do what I need to do. The following is an excerpt from my favorite poem, Bounce Back. Fun fact, the human heart is worth about $400,000. And you've been giving yours out for free. The best part of your outfit is how you wear it on your sleeve, and that kind of generosity does not go unnoticed, poet, artist, listener, singer, whoever you are, you, star, you have weathered each and every endeavor and just keep getting better and better. You are free and untethered. Your presence is lightning. Your cadence is thunder. You have built up these walls, now tear them asunder, because even when the earth shakes, you have a smile that will soften earthquakes. That means you will no longer tremble at the tremors. Instead, you will stand steadfast like Gibraltar. That means you will stand head up and not falter. All of you is welcome here. The inspiration for this poem was, honestly, I was going through a hard time, and you know, I couldn't find anything that was really saying what I felt I needed to hear. And for a while, I didn't think it was a poem that was good enough for me to be performing for people, for me to be doing in shows, and it wasn't until this past year that I started doing it more often that I realized a lot more people felt the same way I did when I was writing this, and there has not been a time where I've done that poem where someone hasn't told me that it's something that they needed to hear, and that's very special to me. I think the connection between artist and audience is beautiful and sacred, and it just fills me with joy and purpose every time I do that poem. Atlanta's where I was born and raised. It made me into the poet I am today. I'm so incredibly thankful for the way the Atlanta spoken word community has fostered me and built me up to where I am today. It truly feels like a family. I cannot express the eternal gratitude I have for the people who have worked with me, who have shared with me. It's been an experience truly like no other. Personally, my favorite places to hear poetry in the city are the Space Open Mic in Kennesaw or the Arts Exchange in East Point, a relatively new open mic that has welcomed me with so much love, called Corazón a Corazón, and my favorite, the Buteco Sounds Open Mic in EAV, which I co-host. If you'd love to hear more of me or my work, you can check out my Instagram at Barbozasaur, that is Barbozasaur. And if you want to see me live, you can do so just about every Tuesday night at the Buteco Sounds Open Mic in East Atlanta Village. Thank you.
Atlanta poet Carlos Barboza and our series Speaking of Poetry. More information about Barboza's work, as well as our entire Speaking of series, is on our website, wabe.org/speakingof. The local arts education and workforce nonprofit Reimagine is presenting their third annual Dream Fest this Wednesday, May 24th at New Realm Brewing. The awards night is a celebration of Atlanta's top creative talent, community organizers, and cultural producers. This year's honorees include Artemis Jenkins, Fahamu Peku, Tyler Perry, and Cam Kirk. The fundraising event is open to the public, and more information is on the website reimagineatl.com/dreamfest. You've been listening to City Lights, our daily exploration of arts and culture. Tomorrow at 11 a.m., we'll help you get your summer reading list ready with suggestions for kids from the owner of Brave and Kind Bookstore and suggestions for adults from writer and self-proclaimed book evangelist Allison Law. If you missed part of today's show, like my earlier conversation with Stacey Abrams about her new political thriller, Rogue Justice, you could catch up through our podcast or on our website, wabe.org/citylights. There you'll find a complete archive of our stories, so you can listen to City Lights on your schedule. City Lights senior producer is Kim Trobes. Our producers are Summer Evans and Janine Etter, and our engineer is Shelley Canavy. I'm your host, Lois Reitzes. Thanks for listening to WABE Atlanta.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is full of mysteries. Are ghosts real? Is that yogurt expired? Hey, the unknown can be scary, but when you donate to WABE, you know where your money is going. Your gift supports the journalism that keeps you informed and the programs that pull back the curtain on complicated stories. Help us make the world less mysterious. Become a member now. Go online to wabe.org/donate, and thanks.